everybody. Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. Having been dealing with, I don't know what it was, stomach virus or whatever, but it's given me a chance to stay pretty much tuned to CNN and MSNBC over the past 48 hours, which has been pretty horrifying. At some point today, a question came up about the coverage. And I guess it was CNN. They had a reporter there near a pile of rubble that had been a building of some sort, a house, I guess. Rescue workers were trying to free a young girl, and she was pinned, her leg was pinned, and the conversation was about having to amputate her leg. Of course, there was no blood, no plasma. They had painkillers, but there was no way to do this amputation without the proper amount of blood and clean bandages. I don't know how that story turned out. I have no idea. There's just been story after story, video feature after video feature coming from there. And I started thinking today, how effective is it to have this kind of 24-hour coverage? It's a horrible tragedy. I just wonder about the coverage, though, and why the networks, the cable networks, feel that we want to watch this. I don't know. I'm pretty confused about the whole issue. It over and over and over again, we've been told it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. Yes, it is, but the main reason for that has to do with colonial Europe and the United States. And the way we have conducted ourselves, the United States, over 200 years with Haiti, ever since Toussaint Louverture led a slave revolt that turned into a national revolution in that country, the United States, including the framers of our Constitution, Thomas Jefferson, a whole gang of people at the beginning of our country were terrified that Louverture's revolution would spread, and a deal was made between Napoleon and Jefferson, I believe, to it had to do with the Louisiana Purchase. If we would allow well, that came subsequent to our allowing a French military force to get escort by the U.S. Navy, such as it was back in the 1790s, turn of the 18th century to the 19th. Very much in intrigue, and I just wonder how many people ever got beyond the novel The Comedians, where it concerns Haiti. So a little bit later in the program tonight, a bit of history for all of us that I think we need to know about Haiti and how it got to where it got to. And it's such a brutal, brutal story, the history of this country and what has occurred now. The latest being reported now by three news organizations, Reuters, Associated Press, and Time Magazine, is that some Haitians, frustrated by the delays of getting help, are stacking corpses and debris as roadblocks to protest the delay in aid reaching Port-au-Prince. There is no infrastructure to speak of in Haiti, thanks to a lot of factors, but And we will get to that. But Haiti is the sort of country that when something breaks and falls to the ground, it's just left there. The story about the corpses is a bit too much to handle. Denny writes, I'm proud of our president for his stand-up response to the horror in Haiti. The death toll is and will be unknown. This was unavoidable. I cannot help thinking of the horror we inflicted on the people of Iraq with shock and awe, which was avoidable. I don't know how to reconcile all this information. Denny. That's, you know, I pulled Denny's email out of a stack that I got. That's exactly how I feel. I don't know how to process this information. What we're seeing on television, the reality of what happened to this country. I know we can say, well, you know, what about New Orleans? What about Indonesia? What about, you know, that's just the way it is. Okay, that's just the way it is. But, knowing our history there, it's hard to reconcile or process everything. John writes, Mike, isn't it sad that our National Guard and Army Reserve can't be fully deployed to assist the horrid catastrophe in Haiti to perform the rescues and medical assistance needed instead of killing and maiming in Iraq and Afghanistan? Yeah, that is awful. The comments yesterday by Pat Robertson and Rush Limbaugh, I wanted to avoid after hearing what those comments were. But if you missed it, we're going to play. We have the audio, right? We're going to play the audio of what these guys said. I can't imagine someone who professes to be, well, whatever. I'll leave it up to you. This is Pat Robertson's comments about the reason Haitians are suffering, and it's because they made a pact with the devil. That's not too far removed from his agreement with Jerry Falwell's remarks that God sent the 9/11 tragedy to America to punish the action of the pagans and the liberals and the feminists and the ACLU here. Now it's Haiti's turn to suffer as a result of what, their devil worship?
Something happened a long time ago in Haiti. And people may not want to talk about it. They were under the heel of the French. You know, Napoleon III and whatever. And they got together and swore a pact to the devil. They said, we will serve you if you'll get us free from the French. It's a true story. And so the devil said, okay, it's a deal. And they kicked the French out. You know, the Haitians revolted and got themselves free. But ever since, they have been cursed by one thing after the other, desperately poor. That island of Hispaniola is one island. Mm-hmm. It's cut down the middle. On the one side is Haiti. On the other side is the Dominican Republic. Yeah. Dominican Republic is prosperous, healthy, full of resorts, etc. Haiti is in desperate poverty. Same islands. Sure. They need to have, and we need to pray for them, a great turning to God. And out of this tragedy, I'm optimistic something good may come.
They made a pact with Satan because they wanted to be free. Listen to this crazy son of a bitch. I don't know why the woman sitting next, I saw the video, and the woman sitting next to him who's humming him, I don't know why she didn't reach into her purse and pull out a club and just, you know, cave his skull in. Or, in a more gently arena, why she didn't just stand up, put her arm under his and lift him up and take him away someplace so he could, you know, continue this kind of insane, obscene conversation. And some of you people wonder why I'm a complete atheist. It has nothing to do with Pat Robertson, but it just reinforces. This is a kind of belief, of course, that permeates just about every religion. There are demons and there are punishments. In this case, according to Pat Robertson, the people of Haiti were punished because they rose up and overthrew their colonial masters. This is a sick man, and he should be put away someplace. He really, really should.
Give you.
past the hour regarding Robertson. Michael writes in, Robertson never misses an opportunity to blame the victim for some vague transgression against Robertson's cloud being. These are some of the poorest people in the world who have made, who've been made that way by an economic system of which Robertson wholeheartedly approves and of which he's a part. And he's taking a dump on the rubble they're buried under to make points with the religious fanatics that follow him. That's cold, man. Yeah, it is. It's very cold.
Was Robertson the televangelist, or which one was the one that had the like the diamond mines in South
Africa? That's Robertson.
Africa? Yeah, so he has no problem exploiting underprivileged stuff.
No, he would tell his brain-dead followers, his cloud-being followers, that he was taking a C-130 transport to pick a country. I don't even know anymore. Uganda, Liberia, Nigeria, I don't know. To take emergency relief supplies. And the purpose of the flight was, the relief supplies was cover. Did he take supplies? Yeah. But the real purpose of the flight was his trip back, where he would bring back so-called blood diamonds. Pat Robertson, if there were such a thing as this garbage he believes in, Pat Robertson would burn forever. Now, Limbaugh, we have two cuts for you on Limbaugh. The second one, we're going to wait until after the break at the bottom of the hour. And again, the main reason I'm going to play both of these is because most of us don't listen to Limbaugh. But the comments he's made regarding this horror in Haiti are so beyond what you would expect from somebody who's sane, somebody who's rational, somebody who has even the tiniest bit of compassion. Now, we know that Limbaugh has none of that. He's not sane. He's not compassionate. He's not rational. Here's the first one. He was saying on his show that Obama is using the Haitian tragedy to show how he can make his mark with both light and dark-skinned African-Americans, playing off the Harry Reid comment.
Yes, I think in the Haiti earthquake, ladies and gentlemen, in the words of Rahm Emanuel, we have another crisis simply too good to waste. This will play right into Obama's hands, humanitarian, compassionate. They'll use this to burnish their credibility with the black community in both light-skinned and dark-skinned black community in this country. It's made to order for them. That's why he couldn't wait to get out there. Here's President Obama speaking about Haiti this morning in Washington at the White House. He held a press conference. Now, I want you to remember it took him 3 days, 3 days to respond to the Christmas Day Fruit of Kaboom bomber. 3 days. And when he came out after those 3 days, he was clearly irritated that he had to do it. He didn't want to do it. He comes out here in less than 24 hours to speak about Haiti.
I have directed my administration to respond with a swift, coordinated, and aggressive effort to save lives. The people of Haiti will have the full support of the United States in the urgent effort to rescue those trapped beneath the rubble and to deliver the humanitarian relief, the food, water, and medicine that Haitians will need in the coming days.
Oh, this is what he lives for. He lives for serving those in misery. Now, but don't misunderstand here, folks. See, this is, I don't have the whole press conference, but I wonder, did he apologize for America before acknowledging we are the only people on earth that can possibly help him out down there in any significant way?
Man. And when you realize, if you want a barometer on the degree to which this country, the United States of America, is sinking into the slime that's created by people like Limbaugh, if you want a barometer on that, you listen to these kinds of words regarding a tragedy such as the one that has hit Haiti. And then you realize that corporate America has no problem at all in supporting this monster. No problem at all. And that he is constantly referred to as a point of authority media are constantly referencing Rush Limbaugh's leadership. So if you need to understand how far gone this culture is, the United States of America, all you have to do is listen to this hideous man and realize the support he gets from corporate America and from his 8, 10, 12, whatever, million ditto heads. It's astonishing. How do we get to this point? Now, if you think that was bad, when we come back, I have a lengthy clip of Limbaugh and one of his callers named April from today. And I just want you to hear it. Stay with us. Before the hour, a couple of you written in that the 11-year-old girl was successfully pulled from the rubble. A hole was made large enough to pull her out, and she's okay with whatever superficial injury she had. We're talking about the 11-year-old who CNN was talking about with the reporter live television. She was trapped, and the rescuers thought they might have to amputate her leg to get her out. And Roz writes, Naomi Klein has some interesting things to say about the U.S. aid for Haiti and how it might be used to benefit the usual suspects in the U.S. The U.S. has always held a grudge against Haiti because of its slave revolt. They had the same grudge against Cuba because the United States couldn't get the better of Castro. Also, notice how black Haitian refugees trying to get to the United States by sea are immediately turned around and sent back, whereas Cubans are allowed in. How racist is that? As for Robinson, that silly old fool, well, somebody should just do us all a favor and shoot him. Roz. The Haitian experience with the United States is obviously doing a big 180 today. How many times have you seen the video? It's not shown so much anymore, but desperate Haitians trying to get their shaky, sinky craft onto shore in the Keys or in mainland Florida, only to be scooped up by the Coast Guard and sent back to the country that they've just fled from. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. But I want you to hear this. And I honestly believe I finally come to the point where I think the country is rotting partly because of people like Limbaugh. We have our political problems. We have our financial problems. We have our international relations problems. But when you have a cancer like Rush Limbaugh, who has been eating away at whatever confidence Americans might have felt for the past 20 years, there comes a time when it has to be removed. It has to be if the society, if the culture has an ice cube's chance in hell of trying to rise above this garbage. Limbaugh has spawned all of these imitators, this entire sick, degenerate movement in this country that even questions the nationality of the President of the United States. If ever there was a time for Limbaugh to be removed, this is the time. Here's a caller who takes him to task for his comments and the comments he later made urging listeners not to send aid to Washington for Haiti because Limbaugh doesn't trust what Obama will do with it. Now listen, first he backpedals from his comments and tries to justify them, and then he calls April a racist, a bigoted blockhead with tampons in her ears.
Back to the phones, we go to Paducah, Kentucky. This is April. That's one of my all-time top 10 favorite female names. April, thank you for calling. Nice to have you with us. Hello.
Thank you, Rush. I'm glad that you chose to have me on today.
Yes.
This is kind of belated, but I just have a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Where in your right mind do you get the cojones to just completely, I don't know, I guess dismiss a tragedy of possibly 100,000 people dead in Haiti? You're going around discouraging people to send donations because we already donated to Haiti and it's called the U.S. income tax. And Obama, the president of our United States, your president as well, whether you like it or not.
Where did you
where
did you hear that I discouraged donations to Haiti?
I read it in a news thing called the Huffington Post, but that's not the point. I was going to finish my sentence, if that's okay with you. What is this you were saying about our president of the United States trying to just basically establish credibility in the black community among white and dark-skinned African Americans? And why do you, like, after saying that, why would you call yourself a patriot?
All right. Now, this is funny. I know that this was our media tweak of the day yesterday, April. You know, what I do here on this program is purposely, I play the media like a violin, like a Stradivarius, and I love tweaking them. I love irritating them, and I love upsetting them. And all I do is take words uttered by liberals and apply them to current events. It was Harry Reid who looked at Obama and said he's a light-skinned guy that doesn't speak.
I'm not talking about Harry Reid.
Well,
I'm talking about you.
I was. You see, this is the point. You didn't listen to the program. You're reading people who take what I say out of context precisely to create this sense of outrage that you have. And it's getting too easy. I mean, you're illustrating how easy it is to outrage these people. I enjoy it. This is a great success. When people start squealing like pigs is when I know I've hit a home run, because we're just needling the media. And they talk about me all the time, and I can create it anytime I want. And it's made you mad, and you believe things they take out of context or don't completely say what I fully say.
Okay, so you're basically evading the second part of my question. You're not going to tell me why you decided to go around saying something, bringing like a tragedy that's happened to hundreds of thousands of people suffering.
No, I'm not evading at all. If I said it, I meant to say it. And I do believe that everything is political to this president. Everything that this president sees is a political opportunity, including Haiti. And he will use it to burnish his credentials with minorities in this country and around the world, and to accuse Republicans of having no compassion. I predicted yesterday, you know, how come there's no outrage, by the way, at Bill Clinton suggesting that Obama's nothing more than a slave? When he's trying to get Ted Kennedy to endorse him, endorse Hillary, and he says, come on, Ted, you know, this guy, a few years ago, this guy be fetching us our coffee. You're not outraged about that because the Huffington Post isn't outraged about it. They probably don't write about it. But I talk about
all... Actually, are you implying that the Huffington Post is the one and only resource that I watch?
No. I'm not implying it. What I'm illustrating here is that you're a blockhead. What I'm illustrating here is that you're a close-minded bigot who is ill-informed. I am being patient and tolerant, and I'm trying to explain this to you, and you're totally closed to it. I'm hitting you with piercing, penetrating logic, and it escapes you. I did not say don't donate. I did say this Obama will use this to help burnish his credentials, because there's no question he will. He got out. I'll tell you something else I said, April. Took him 3 days to go out and talk about the Christmas Day underwear bomber. Took him less than 18 hours to get out there and start rallying people about about this earthquake. To accuse me of politicizing everything is to be ignorant about what I do on this program. I simply react to the left. They're the ones that politicize virtually everything that's happening, from health care to terrorism.
Oh my God.
And I love illustrating absurdity by being absurd. And if you had listened to this program for a modicum of time, you would know it. Mm. But instead, you're a blockhead. Your mind is totally closed. You got tampons in your ears.
Nice. Oh my God. So it's the other people who are politicizing everything, you see. It's the people on the left who are politicizing everything, including health care. This man needs to be removed from the airwaves. He needs to be removed from this culture if this culture is to have a chance to try to heal itself. And not just Limbaugh, but especially Limbaugh. Certainly not only Limbaugh. But when you think about the spawn that he's put out there, when you realize that the head of the Republican National Committee can make a comment and Limbaugh will disagree with it, and the head of the Republican National Committee can ask for forgiveness within 24 hours. I don't know. It's hard for me to realize that I live in a country, in a culture, I should say, that a devil like this has been produced, in which a devil like this, someone who is, you know, he's paid $40 million, or is it $50 million a year. That's $1 million a week to say these things on his radio program. $1 million a week. And there is a cult of his followers, and Becks, and Palins, and the rest of these people that represent nothing except ignorance, racism, hatred, sickness, the spooky demon and God belief. They are hell-bent to destroy this country and won't be satisfied until it is destroyed. And what do we do? The part that is shocking, beyond shocking to me, is that corporate America supports this man. That there are media companies that put this man on the air so that people can listen to this. That's the part that to me is just astonishing.
Right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, I made the point before, and Tom in Minneapolis makes the point, the ruling class needs the kind of poison that Rush Limbaugh pumps into the society. And because if people wake up to the truth of what the ruling class or the elites or capitalism, predatory capitalism, whatever you want to say, you know, and we're not supposed to ever talk about that. It's ingrained in us from the time we're little, right? It's like the struggle that Catholic kids have in trying to outgrow Catholicism when they become old enough to think and become rational. It's almost an impossible move. We have been taught that we don't challenge the ruling class. Well, Rush Limbaugh is someone who is, I've said this before, he is the, he provides the protection for corporate America that supports him unequivocally, with no restrictions. Have you ever heard of Limbaugh's program or Limbaugh being chastised the way a pig like Glenn Beck has been? Of course not. This is going to probably run over into the next hour, but Ted Rall, who's an illustrator as well as a political writer, presents the question a lot of people who are not fully aware of what really happened. How did Haiti get so poor? How many times did you see that over the past 24, 40 hours on the bottom of your screen? Poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, yada, yada, yada. As Ted writes, despite a century of American colonialism, occupation, and propping up of corrupt dictators, how did it get so poor? Even though the CIA staged coups against every democratic elected president they ever had. Haiti. It's an important question. An earthquake isn't just an earthquake. The same 7-point tremor hitting San Francisco wouldn't kill nearly as many people as in Port-au-Prince. The director of the Environmental Science Research Institute, University of Ulster, Northern Ireland, said, quote, looking at the pictures, essentially it looks as if the buildings are of breeze block or cinder block construction. And what you need in an earthquake zone is metal bars that connect the blocks so that they stay together when they're shaken. In a wealthy country, he goes on, with good seismic building codes that are enforced, you would have some damage, but not very much. End quote. When a pile of cinder blocks falls on you, your odds of survival are long. Even if you miraculously survive, a poor country like Haiti doesn't have the equipment, communications infrastructure, or emergency service personnel to pull you out of the rubble in time. And if your neighbors get you out, there's no ambulance to take you to the hospital or doctor to treat you once you get there. Earthquakes are random events. How many people they kill is predetermined. In Haiti this week, don't blame the tectonic plates. 99% of the death toll is attributable to poverty. So the question is relevant. How did Haiti become so poor? Story begins in 1910. Actually, Ted, it's before that, but we'll start there. The story begins in 1910 when U.S. State Department, National City Bank of New York, now called Citibank, Consortium, it's a consortium between U.S. State Department and National City Bank of New York, bought the Banque Nationale d'Haïti, Haiti's only commercial bank, and its national treasury, in effect, transferring Haiti's debts to the Americans. 5 years later, President Woodrow Wilson ordered troops to occupy the country in order to keep tabs on our investment. From 1915 to 1934, the U.S. Marines imposed harsh military occupation, murdered Haitian patriots, and diverted 40% of Haiti's gross domestic product to U.S. banks. Haitians were banned from government jobs. Ambitious Haitians were shunted into the puppet military, setting the stage for a half century of U.S.-backed military dictatorship. The U.S. kept control of Haiti's finances until 1947. Still, why should Haitians complain? Sure, we stole 40% of Haiti's national wealth for 32 years, but we let them keep 60%. Whiners. Despite having been bled dry by American bankers and generals, civil disorder prevailed until 1957 when the CIA installed President for Life François Papadoc Duvalier. Duvalier's brutal Tantan Macoute paramilitary goon squads murdered at least 30,000 Haitians and drove educated people to flee into exile. But think of the cup as half full. Fewer people in the population means fewer people competing for the same jobs. Upon Papadoc's death in 1971, the torch passed to his even more dissolute 19-year-old son, Jean-Claude Baby Doc Duvalier. The U.S., cool to Papadoc in his later years, quickly warmed back up to his kleptomaniacal playboy heir. As the U.S. poured in arms and trained his army as a supposed anti-communist bulwark against Castro's Cuba, Baby Doc stole an estimated $300 to $800 million from the national treasury. The money was placed in personal accounts in Switzerland and elsewhere. Under U.S. influence, Baby Doc virtually eliminated import tariffs for U.S. goods. Soon Haiti was awash in predatory agricultural imports dumped by American firms. Domestic rice farmers went bankrupt. A nation that had been agriculturally self-sustaining collapsed. Farms were abandoned. Hundreds of thousands of farmers migrated to the teeming slums of Port-au-Prince. The Duvalier era, 29 years in all, came to an end in 1986 when President Ronald Reagan ordered U.S. forces to take Baby Doc to exile in France, saving Baby Doc from a popular uprising. Yet despite everything we've done for Haiti, there's still a fourth world failed state on a fault line. And still, we haven't given up. American companies like Disney generously pay wages to their sweatshop workers of 28 cents an hour in Haiti. What more do these ingrates want? Unspeakable situation in Haiti, a country that the United States has exploited for 200 years. Regarding that, Diane in Pittsburgh writes, Mike, remember the old Roseanne TV show? There was a really great line I remember from one episode. Roseanne's husband and a bunch of his buddies were sitting around the poker table, and someone, a black man, made a comment about some atrocity committed by the white man. One of the white men, that he was tired of everyone blaming everything on the white man, to which his black friend replied, well, you did everything. Kind of like our country. Diane, Pittsburgh. Robert Perry. In modern times, when Haiti does intrude on U.S. consciousness, it's usually because of some natural disaster or a violent political upheaval. And the U.S. response is often paternalistic, if not tinged with a racial disdain for the country's predominantly black population and its seemingly endless failure to escape cycles of crushing poverty. However, more than two centuries ago, Haiti represented one of the most important neighbors of the new American Republic and played a central role in enabling the United States to expand westward. If not for Haiti, the course of U.S. history could have been very different, with the United States possibly never expanding much beyond the Appalachian Mountains. In the 1700s, then called San Domingue, and covering the western third of the island of Hispaniola, San Domingue, Haiti was a French colony that rivaled the American colonies as the most valuable European possession in the Western Hemisphere. Relying on a ruthless exploitation of African slaves, French plantations there produced nearly one half the world's coffee and sugar. Many of the great cities of France owe their grandeur to the wealth that was extracted from Haiti and its slaves, but the human price was unspeakably high. The French had devised a fiendishly cruel slave system that imported enslaved Africans for work in the fields with accounting procedures for their amortization, meaning they were literally worked to death. The American colonists may have rebelled against Great Britain over issues such as representation in Parliament, and arbitrary actions by King George III, but black Haitians confronted a brutal system of slavery. An infamous French method of executing a troublesome slave was to insert a gunpowder charge into his rectum and then detonate the explosive. So as the American colonies fought for their freedom in the 1770s, and as that inspiration against tyranny spread to France in the 1780s, the repercussions would eventually reach Haiti, where the Jacobins' cry of liberty, equality, and fraternity resonated with special force. Slaves demanded that the concepts of freedom be applied universally. When the brutal French plantation system continued, violent slave uprisings followed. Hundreds of white plantation owners were slain as the rebels overran the country. A self-educated slave named Toussaint Louverture emerged as the revolution's leader, demonstrating skills on the battlefield and in the complexities of politics. Despite the atrocities committed by both sides of the conflict, the rebels, known as the Black Jacobins, gained the sympathy of the American Federalist Party, and particularly Alexander Hamilton, a native of the Caribbean himself. Hamilton, the first U.S. Treasury Secretary, helped Louverture draft a constitution for the new nation. But events in Paris and Washington soon conspired to undo the promise of Haiti's new freedom. Despite Hamilton's sympathies, some founders, including Thomas Jefferson, who owned 180 slaves and owed his political strength to agrarian interests, some looked nervously at the slave rebellion in Saint Domingue. If something is not done, and done soon, Jefferson wrote in 1797, we shall be murderers of our own children. Meanwhile, across the Atlantic, the chaos and excesses of the French Revolution led to the ascendance of Napoleon Bonaparte, a brilliant and vain military commander possessed of legendary ambition. As he expanded his power across Europe, Napoleon also dreamed of rebuilding a French empire in the Americas. In 1801, Jefferson became the third president of the United States, and his interests at least temporarily aligned with those of Napoleon. The French dictator was determined to restore French control of Saint-Domingue, and Jefferson was eager to see the slave rebellion crushed. Through secret diplomatic channels, Napoleon asked Jefferson if the United States would help a French army traveling by sea to Saint-Domingue. Jefferson replied that, quote, nothing will be easier than to furnish your army and fleet with everything and reduce Louverture to starvation. But Napoleon had a secret second phase of his plan that he didn't share with Jefferson. Once the French army had subdued Louverture and his rebel force, Napoleon intended to advance to the North American mainland, basing a new French empire in New Orleans and settling the vast territory west of the Mississippi River. In May 1801, Jefferson picked up the first inklings of Napoleon's other agenda. Alarmed at the prospect of a major European power controlling New Orleans and thus the mouth of the strategic Mississippi River, Jefferson backpedaled on his commitment to Napoleon, retreating to a posture of neutrality. Still, terrified at the prospect of a successful republic organized by freed African slaves, Jefferson took no action to block Napoleon's thrust into the New World. In 1802, a French expeditionary force achieved initial success against the slave army, driving Louverture's forces back into the mountains. But as they retreated, the ex-slaves torched the cities and the plantations, destroying the colony's once thriving economic infrastructure. Louverture, hoping to bring the war to an end, accepted Napoleon's promise of a negotiated settlement that would ban future slavery in the country. As part of the agreement, Louverture turned himself in. Napoleon, however, broke his word. Jealous of Louverture, who was regarded by some admirers as a general with skills rivaling Napoleon's, the French dictator had Louverture shipped in chains back to Europe, where he was mistreated and died in prison. Infuriated by the betrayal, The Vautier's young generals resumed the war with a vengeance. In the months that followed, the French army, already decimated by disease, was overwhelmed by a fierce enemy fighting in familiar terrain and determined not to be put back into slavery. Napoleon sent a second French army, but it too was destroyed. Though the famed general had conquered much of Europe, he lost 24,000 men, including some of his best troops, in Saint-Domingue before abandoning his campaign. The death toll among the ex-slaves was much higher, but they had prevailed, albeit over a devastated land. In 1803, a frustrated Napoleon, denied his foothold in the New World, agreed to sell New Orleans and the Louisiana territories to Jefferson. Ironically, the Louisiana Purchase, which opened the heart of the present United States to American settlement, had been made possible despite Jefferson's misguided collaboration with Napoleon. Stanford University professor John Chester Miller wrote in his book, The Wolf by the Ears, Thomas Jefferson and Slavery, quote, by their long and bitter struggle for independence, Saint-Domingue's blacks were instruments in allowing the United States to more than double the size of its territory. But, Professor Miller observed, quote, the decisive contribution made by the black freedom fighters went almost unnoticed by the Jeffersonian administration, end quote. The loss of Louvatier's leadership dealt a severe blow to Haiti's prospects, according to Jefferson scholar Paul Finkelman of Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Had Toussaint lived, it's very likely that he would have remained in power long enough to put the nation, on a firm footing, to establish an order of succession. Finkelman said in an interview, the entire subsequent history of Haiti might have been different. More in a moment. Megatons, well, who's left when the war is won? A soldier of a misfortune, a soldier of an angry call, soldiers on foreign soil. Well, we're not here to fight your war, 'cause we know what you're fighting for.
Mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people. It's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour, continuing Robert Perry has written today about Haiti's tragic history being entwined with the history of this country. Anyway, after the revolt, was the revolution in Haiti was ended, and Toussaint Louverture, who had led this revolt, was after he was dead. Louverture had not been in power long enough to establish a bureaucracy, a government. It was all revolution, and he died before he had a chance to do that. Haiti might have advanced, but instead the island nation, Perry writes, continued a downward spiral. And for some scholars, Jefferson's vengeful policy toward Haiti, like his personal ownership of slaves, similar to his personal ownership of slaves, represented an ugly blemish on his legacy as an historic advocate of freedom. Even in his final years, Jefferson remained obsessed with Haiti and its link to the issue of American slavery. In the 1820s, the former president proposed a scheme for taking away the children born to black slaves in the United States and shipping them to Haiti. Jefferson proposed this. In that way, Jefferson posited that both slavery and America's black population could be phased out. Eventually, in Jefferson's view, Haiti would be all black and the United States all white. Jefferson's deportation scheme never was taken very seriously, and American slavery would continue for another four decades until it was ended by the Civil War. The official hostility of the United States toward Haiti extended almost as long, ending in 1862 when President Lincoln finally granted diplomatic recognition to that country. By then, however, Haiti's destructive patterns of political violence and economic chaos had been long established, continuing up to the present time. Personal and political connections between Haiti's light-skinned elite and power centers in Washington also have lasted through today. Recent Republican administrations have been particularly hostile to the popular will of the impoverished Haitian masses. When leftist priest Jean-Bertrand Aristide was twice elected by overwhelming margins, he was ousted both times, first during the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush, and then again under George W. Bush. Washington's conventional wisdom on Haiti holds that the country is a hopeless basket case that would best be governed by business-oriented technocrats who would take their marching orders from the United States. However, the Haitian people have a different perspective. Unlike most Americans who have no idea about their historic debt to Haiti, many Haitians know this history quite well. The bitter memories of Jefferson and Napoleon still feed the distrust that Haitians of all classes feel toward the outside world. Aristide once told Perry in an interview, quote, "In Haiti, we became the first black independent country. We understand, as we still understand, it wasn't easy for them, American, French, and others, to accept our independence." This happens so often, especially in this hemisphere, when there's a tragedy. That was Robert Perry in today's consortium news.org. When there's a tragedy in this hemisphere with one of the countries here, it's then and only then that we start to understand or try to deal with the intertwined history of the countries suffering the tragedy and the United States. And invariably, in the Western Hemisphere, with the exception of Canada, you find it without let up. You know, go ahead, tell me a country other than Canada. Because Canadians are white and Canadians speak English and French the same as we do, although most Americans are a little bit suspicious of that Quebec province where they speak French. What's up with that, right? But I defy you to tell me a country in the Western Hemisphere that the United States has not, over the course of our history, brutally oppressed, suppressed, extracted their natural resources, forced their people to live in poverty, forced them to accept slavery. Name one. Go ahead. And then when the duly elected leaders of some of these Latin American countries reveal that they are in fact left progressives, oh, doesn't the United States government, I don't care if it's Democratic or Republican, don't they just go berserk? Don't they try anything and everything to destabilize or overthrow these governments? It's astonishing.
afraid, be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. And I honestly wish that American television would cleanse itself from this seemingly inability to not get involved in disaster porn. What else do you call it? These endless, the endless footage of this graphic wreckage and the corpses and the people that are hurting. To what end? What is the point in showing that without putting it in context? And the context is what's been written about today by Max Blumenthal and Robert Perry and who else? Ted Rall. The context is what the United States has done to this country. And Bill Clinton, let's not forget Clinton, when he signed the North American Free Trade Agreement, it condemned Haiti to even further destruction and death. But how many Americans understand that Haitians, when they make that trip across the Florida Straits on a raft trying to get to the United States, and when they finally get here, that when they are scooped up by immigration, they're held in a detention center long enough for a judge to say, get them out of here. And when black Cubans come here, they're allowed to stay. So what's the difference between a black Haitian and a black Cuban? One speaks French of a sort, one speaks Spanish of a sort. What's the difference? It's a political difference, isn't it? Castro had the temerity to give the middle finger to the United States and has managed to maintain his government for half a century. But, you know, Haiti will fade. The American press corps back during Bush 2 did not provide the truth about the overthrow of Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. They didn't cover Clinton, who forced Aristide to sign these free trade agreements that destroyed the rural economy as a condition for returning him to power. And then after Bush 1 had him removed, Clinton let him come back, provided that Aristide would sign documents guaranteeing the end of his country. And then Bush, too, had him thrown out again. It's incredible. And the first introduction most people have to these countries is something like this. And if you try to talk about this, if you try to talk about the slaughter of Central Americans during, just take one period, just during the Reagan years. If you try to talk about the history of someone like John Negroponte, who organized the death squads in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, if you try to talk about this, you immediately get this rising tide of screeching from these brain-dead right-wingers and Republicans who say, "Oh, you're going to blame America." Yeah. They have no sense of history, no sense of political history whatsoever, and just this blank-eyed, Limbaugh-inspired, drooling, flag-waving horse crap. Don't you get tired of it? Don't you get tired of living in a country that is so, that just chock-a-block with people who are so goddamn stupid and ignorant, don't even understand their own history, and will not take the time to find out about it? And when you show them irrefutable evidence, oh, well, who put that together? That's one of those textbook companies, right? They don't even believe in God. Who put that together, huh? Some left-leaning politician, well, Democrat, right? I don't believe that crap. Even when you show them the historical truth, Nothing. Nothing. And honest to God, it is just these clots of uselessness that Rush Limbaugh is, that perpetuates this day in and day out. You know, it's one thing to be a entertainer. He's not an entertainer. He's a propagandist of the highest order. He's a protector of corporate America. And he's a scum, just absolute human scum. And yet you have people who swear by it. And his whole spawn of these scummy goddamn people, you know who they are. I wonder if we're ever going to escape this. I don't think so. I don't think we will. All right, let's do a Prairie 2 report. And then your phone calls for the rest of the program. Prairie 2 writes, initial jobless claims were up more than expected last week. Continuing claims dropped by more than 200,000 because people on extended benefits aren't counted. They also don't count people whose extended benefits have run out and have moved to hardcore poverty. Welfare isn't available for most of these people thanks to the Welfare to Work program of Bill Clinton. At least we don't live in the libertarian paradise of Haiti, a country whose government regulation of corporations is ranked right at the bottom of the list worldwide. Haiti became one of the first countries to be totally globalized, thanks to Bill Clinton, who got their agreement to this formula for poverty literally at the point of a gun in 1995. He also embargoed their police and emergency service to make them more dependent on the international community, which is multiplying the current suffering. Those sprawling hillside slums you've been seeing on television did not exist before Clinton destroyed the livelihood of Haiti's rice farmers. Not that there wasn't a lot of poor people already, but Bill Clinton was not the first president to screw with their economy. Haiti was one of the world's biggest sugarcane producers, but Reagan needed to create a market for U.S. corn sweetener, so they had to go. Reagan wasn't the first either. Haiti became the second republic in the Americas after a slave revolt in 1802, and this never sat well with the slave-holding U.S. business interests. Even after the Civil War, they didn't want uppity descendants of slaves getting ahead in the world. If you think this is tragic, but doesn't really affect us, you need to consider that Clinton's NAFTA drove more than 10 million homeless Mexican farmers north. The farm refugees that didn't cross the border live in the slums around corporate farming operations in Mexico, where the swine flu made its jump to humans. We dodged that bullet, if you weren't one of the thousands who died needlessly from swine flu. We have encampments of working poor here in the United States. If the conservatives have their way and end all government social programs, we will have Haiti-style slums here. The UN has now put Bill Clinton in charge of bringing sweatshops to Haiti to use all the cheap labor he created. We're still losing 250,000 jobs a month in the United States. It'll be our turn for shanty towns and sweatshops soon enough. You go to his website, prairienumeral2.com. Do you feel, overwhelmed when a tragedy, yes, a genuine, horrific tragedy like this occurs? Like the situation in Haiti. And then the coverage begins, and you know it's going to be nonstop. It's the damnedest thing. As horrifying as it is, it's as though everything else stops, and the networks, the cable networks, and to a lesser degree, but right in there, the broadcast networks provide endless coverage of the most horrific aspects of this horrific event. For what? To what end? What is the point? You know, there's reporters who are down there, and you can always tell when it's a very important foreign story, because all of a sudden the coats and ties go and the sleeves get rolled up, and the best in outdoors outfitters clothing all of a sudden appears on these people, the khakis and this and that, and you can see little sweat stains. You have to wonder if they weren't sprayed on before the cameras come on. And yet the same media that is so willing to act like a bunch of flies around a corpse and just swarm, they have absolutely, they seem to have no obligation, sense of obligation, to tell us the truth about these countries before the disasters happen. Nah. Nah.
Why don't the newscasters cry when they read about people who die? At least they could be decent enough to put just a tear in their eyes. But Mama said, it's just make-believe. You can't believe everything you see. So baby, close your eyes to the lullaby.
Listening to Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
Before the hour, you know, there's been some hearings on in Washington from these predatory vampires who run the major investment banks, so-called investment, my ass. Of course, we will not get those hearings. We will see endless video loops of death and destruction in Haiti, about which we can do nothing at this point except try to save as many people as we can. But the story that will have profound effect on has had a profound effect on our society, the story that unless the particulars are changed is going to drive us to even worse poverty and unemployment and sickness and disease, and we're already approaching that story, is not being given coverage. Nothing. And that is about the those corrupt bank thugs. As Arthur writes, before a commission on the eve of their bank's payout of billion-dollar bonuses, which were not earned and produce absolutely nothing of value for the country. So we have a contrast. Arthur writes, two events have coincided this week to spotlight the stark contrast between wealth and poverty. First is the hearing in Washington. Second, a devastating earthquake, which focused the world's attention on the human disaster and abject poverty of the citizens of Haiti. But the irony of these two situations is totally lost in this country. This country cannot, first of all, doesn't understand irony. And then another story that caught my eye today, and my God, this was in New York Times, surprise, surprise, on about page 9, but a wave of American companies has been arriving in Iraq in recent months to pursue what is expected to be a multi-billion dollar bonanza of projects to revive that country's stagnant petroleum industry. It's not about the oil. As the Times says, since the 2003 American-led invasion, nearly all of the biggest reconstruction projects in Iraq have been controlled by the United States. but many rebuilding contracts are expected to be awarded as soon as this month for drilling hundreds of new wells, repairing thousands of miles of pipelines, yada, 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 yada. And guess who's right there? Among the companies that have started sending workers and equipment to the country or have plans to do so are Halliburton, Baker Hughes, Weatherford International, and Schlumberger, all Houston-based oil services companies. And, of course, let's not forget the engineering giants Kellogg Brown and Root, Bechtel, Parsons, Fluor, and Foster Wheeler. Huh? Yay! Halliburton and its former subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, as well as Bechtel and Parsons, have been singled out for criticism by the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction for their previous work in Iraq. But no matter. It doesn't matter. The spokespig for Kellogg Brown & Root, someone named Heather Brown, said, quote, KBR has historic experience on previous oil and gas production projects ranging from Azerbaijan to Kazakhstan. Our pursuit of additional contracts in the region is based on this experience, in addition to KBR's work on Project Rio, Restore Iraq Oil. Yeah. See, I guess I figure since it's been 7 years now since the invasion... 7 years since the invasion and 8 years since the global protests that insisted no blood for oil. It's all about the oil. It's been 7 years, just a month or two shy of 7 years. So as far as the United States is concerned and its misguided citizens, time to move because nobody will remember. This is why media do not cover the multi-hundreds of thousands of people who take to the streets in protest. If it's not on television, there's no collective memory of it. And remember, television's sole function is to make us forget. So, demonstrations? 7 years ago? What? Huh? Really? Where? When? How? What's this... These left-wing lies that 10, 20 million people around the planet demonstrated against the invasion, the planned invasion of Iraq? Really? I didn't see any of that. Where? London, you say? Paris? Where else? Beijing? Moscow? Buenos Aires? Mexico City? Toronto? No, that didn't happen. So 7 years has passed now, and corporate America figures, okay, all right, let's go. Let's get in there. Come on, Kellogg Brown and Root, my God, the Bechtel Corporation. That's the one George Shultz, former Secretary of State, used to run. Halliburton. And what are we going to do about it? Welcome back. 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Show. Oh, well, by the way, yesterday, the chairman and CEO of Goldman Sachs that has been ripping off monetary systems for how many decades? Centuries? He acknowledged yesterday that his company had engaged in what he called improper behavior. Lloyd Blankfein made the shocking acknowledgement before the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. I don't even want to get into it. Nothing will happen because of that. Nothing. Dan is in Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the mic. Hey, Dan.
Good evening, Mike.
Hi.
I'm calling about an article I read in today's Washington Post, which really put Obama's humanitarian relief effort in perspective. The article said that the president is sending $100 million worth of aid immediately. And, of course, that adds up to less than 1% of the $30 billion devoted to the current escalation in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And, by the way, I read on, I believe it was counterpunch.org, that Obama is requesting another $33 billion for the Iraq and Afghan wars, part of a record $708 billion overall appropriation for the Pentagon.
Yeah, how about that?
And finally, I saw somewhere online that Barack Obama is enlisting the help of, guess who? George W. Bush, of all people, to go to Haiti and help out there. I can already imagine Obama saying, George, you're doing a heck of a job.
Now, wait a minute. George W. Bush to go to Haiti for what? But he doesn't do anything. George W. Bush doesn't do anything. I mean,
I just saw that somewhere online. That could be apocryphal, but.
Yeah, I have my doubts about that. What the hell would George W. Bush do in Haiti?
Well, his mom could gloat over the people being housed in tents. They've got it so much better than they had it before.
I meant other than that.
You got me. You really got me.
Yeah.
And I'll spare us all by not mentioning how much I hate callous troglodytes like Rush Limbaugh and Pat Robertson.
Isn't Robertson just, I mean, is that not astonishing? Robertson states categorically the Haitians made a deal with Satan.
The guy's a monster.
Just he is.
A monster.
Absolutely is. Hey, thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
All right, take care. And I'll bet his contributions, Robertson's a scaly son of a bitch, I bet his contributions didn't drop off one single dollar. There were people at home, I'm sure, watching the 700 Club saying, Mike's in Chicago. Hey, Mike.
Hey, what's going on, Mike? For your last caller, I need to make a correction for him. George W. Bush and Bill Clinton are in charge of the fundraising for Haiti, which is even worse because when Bush was president, he wouldn't have urinated in the mouths of the Haitian people if their teeth were on fire.
So that's what he was talking about.
Yeah, that's what he was talking about. And, you know, speaking of irony, when you were talking about this before, if you were looking at the United States through the Haitian people's eyes, isn't it ironic how we sent so many of our people over there, which is a great thing, but yet our government's fighting to give us free health care? You know, it's so ironic, and no one brings that point up, which, you know. Oh, and speaking of Bechtel also, correct me if I'm wrong, but if my facts are right, isn't Bechtel the company that bought the rights to the water distribution to a small Mexican village? And the small print said that they get the rain also, and soon these people were literally fighting in the streets for water because it got so bad.
I believe that was Bechtel, and if it wasn't, it was a company very similar to Bechtel. A lot of these corporate predators are starting to realize something. Their corporations have so polluted the atmosphere, the earth and the groundwater, that people are going to be fighting over water in the not so distant future. So why not sign up the water rights now? It's incredible. It's what Naomi Klein refers to as disaster capitalism. You create this kind of chaos and then immediately figure out a way to make money, which they never fail to do.
Yeah, and you know, the thing about it is if you have no regulation at all, the minute you try to instill even the slightest amount of regulation, you're all of a sudden socialist.
Yeah.
If we would have started regulating these companies from the get-go, you can at least drop it down a little and that would look good. But starting at ground zero, where are you going to go from there?
Right. Well, at one time, as you know, there was some sort of regulation. We had a whole alphabet soup of regulatory agencies, and starting with Bush and Cheney turned it into an art to absolutely destroy those agencies without destroying them. All they did was assign to the chairmanships of those agencies people who would work to do the exact opposite of what, say, the Food and Drug Administration was designed to do, what else?
Wasn't it the woods and natural resources that the guy in charge of the Bush put was in charge of the lumber industry like right. a year before or something?
Right.
You know, it's just, right. and before I let you go, I called Stephanie's show today to let her know there's a gentleman named Nate Decimus, who's considered one of the highest priests of New Orleans Haitian voodoo, and maybe people would be interested in giving this guy a call and letting him know about Pat Robertson's comments, because he was the same one who talked about Katrina and they deserved it because of right. Mardi Gras. So if I could, the gentleman's number is area code 774-274-9391, and he is considered one of the highest priests of New Orleans Haitian voodoo.
Now, what is it? What's the number again?
His number is 774, area code 274-9391. And I think he'd be interested in knowing about Pat Robertson's comments.
And you want people to call just to inform?
Yeah, and just, you know, bounce it off of him and think of, you know, what his opinion is about Pat Robertson's comments between Katrina, they deserved it because, you know, their harlot lifestyle, and Mardi Gras, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
all
okay,
right.
Well, Mike, I'll let you go, but I'll talk to you soon, and thanks, my friend.
You bet. Take care, Mike. That's a great idea, calling a Haitian voodoo priest in New Orleans and informing this man. Of course, I'm sure that he is well aware of Pat Robertson's comments, wouldn't you think? James is in...
Hey, Mike.
Oregon. Hey, James.
Hey, Mike. How you doing? I just want to bring up the point of, there are people trying to dig up survivors right now in the dark. What's passing for hospitals in Haiti are in the dark, but there seems to be plenty of electricity to beam these horrendous images into every one of our living rooms.
Yeah, the little power, gas operated or kerosene operated diesels. I wonder, or generators. I wonder where they're getting the fuel to run them. Or I don't know. It's sort of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the only point I wanted to bring up. I worked in the Loma Prieta quake. I had a 350 kW plant. And we were lighting up, whole neighborhoods for people to be dug out.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of those can just be easily fit. Actually, you can get two of those things inside a container and run those things all day long. And probably with just one container, you can light up the whole country. But, you know, the news media comes in. They bring their own, their own food, their own water, their own electricity, and I can think of just so much better use. Or even just a little bit of that electricity to go to, let somebody operate and light or light up an area to try to dig people out.
Yeah, I agree with you, James. Another aspect, thanks, James. Another aspect of that, they're talking about how the relief supplies are sitting offshore. They can't get them in because apparently the only port Port-au-Prince in Haiti that was able to handle these cargo ships has been destroyed. We airlifted to Berlin, West Berlin. I mean, we had an airlift that provided the citizens of West Berlin with everything for months. We can't do it now? Just hold yourself.
soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Stephen is in Burbank listening on Sirius. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Mike.
Hey.
There is a word that needs definition. We need to get this political thought circulating through our brain cells. And here it says, to politicize is to transform an activity that seems to have no political connotations into one that is consciously bent towards political ends.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other definitions attached to that word political. There is political economy, political obligation, political thought. Oh, I just went through that. And then there are other words that the right wing tries to make us think are bad words. And we don't have to dance to that tune. Like if a worker works his job, gets the paycheck, cashes it, he is entitled to those benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, that paycheck, by definition, can be defined as being an entitlement, if I'm not wrong.
Sure, but it's also earned wages.
And not only that, you look at Haiti and what happened to it throughout all its history. And I'm saying this, they are entitled to whatever relief they can get. The more there is, the better it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just hoping that we can, you know, just get the right wing to just knock it off with this Pavlovian, buzz phrase crap that makes us dance there too. We don't have to. We can understand things the way they really are, like the way they really are in the real world. And the real world is there's pain and suffering, and it was caused by, I hate to say it, capitalism. And so now there's an obligation.
Mm-hmm.
They are entitled. We are obliged to do to help correct the problems that we caused.
Well, that's a good point, Stephen. Thank you. But it's a point that most Americans can't handle. We are very ignorant people. We really are. Even those of us who claim not to be so ignorant, we are a very ignorant people about the little side streets of our history down which we went in order to mug other countries and beat them up and steal their resources and kill them. The reputation that the United States has built over the past 200 years, especially the past 100 years, is not a reputation that anyone could be proud of. I mean, if you were a father in the United States showed up and wanted to marry your daughter, you would chase the son of a bitch off your front porch. We're not a country that has a reputation of the very things that we've been brainwashed into believing this country stands for. This country does not stand for freedom, justice, equal opportunity, human rights. We do not. Jesus Christ, by definition, we don't. You can even go back to our foundational documents and you don't find that. None of that. It's not there. But any attempt to hold a discussion about what this country has been about for 230 years, you usually you hit a brick wall with people who just don't care. If you talk to liberals, they are progressives, they will show some interest, but everybody's too busy right now just trying to survive. If you bring this up with conservatives or Republicans, they tell you you're un-American and that Sarah Palin and Glenn Beck will save us from the likes of you. It really is kind of a losing proposition. How do you educate 300 plus million people all at once as to what the fatherland has been doing? The homeland, oh, that's right, fatherland is German. What the homeland has been doing, why we are in the situation we're in domestically and in the international forum or arena. Who knows this stuff, you see? And then we have a disaster, a horrifying event like this earthquake. And we have the pigs, the scum in this society, like Limbaugh and Robertson, who say the things that they say. And how many Robertson cult members listened to that yesterday and said, yeah, well, I don't know what he means about they did what with France? Well, goddamn, if Pat says it. And then the millions who listen to this bloated son of a bitch on Premier Radio Network, Rush Limbaugh, and the rest of his spawn. I mean, as long as this culture, this society, produces people like these two and their offshoots and gives them forums where they can spout this and then let them hide behind the idea of free speech. What? Corporate America determines which speech is free and which isn't.
The voice inside your head. It's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour. Hack is in Oklahoma City listening on Sirius. Hack, welcome to the program.
Michael, you sexy beast. How's it going?
I'm getting by.
Man, I'm telling you what, Pat Robertson may not have realized it, but he might have actually given us all incentive to become born-again Christians.
Yeah?
Do you really want to be left behind in the rapture with the likes of this a-hole?
What, wouldn't he be raptured?
No, he would not be raptured.
Oh.
If the rapture came, it would definitely miss him.
I can't believe that somebody like Robertson, who's come to define religious pimpdom. Not much, but this guy Robertson and Falwell before him, and there have been many more, but this one is the one we're talking about now. Pat Robertson has turned Christianity into the same thing that a pimp turns women into. And he collects the money. He collects the money. I can't believe this guy.
You know, I hear a lot about this sort of thing, and my usual reply to him is, if they really like theocracy so much, move to Iran.
You're right.
Get a functioning theocracy there.
Yeah, they do.
The only thing, Mike, that keeps me hanging on sometimes is the thought that, for all of our faults, this is a great country, not because of people like Limbaugh and Robertson, but in spite of them.
Well, I agree with that, but again, like I said earlier in the program, just using a sickness/health analogy. If you're sick and you find out that you've got a tumor inside you that hasn't metastasized, what do you do? The first thing you do is cut it out. Not that you couldn't live with it. If it's not malignant, you could probably live with it for the rest of your life. But it's a tumor. It needs to be removed. So you go have the surgery and you get it removed. And then, 2 weeks later, you sit with your surgeon and say, "Whew, man, glad that's over." That's how I see people like Limbaugh and Beck and Robertson and Palin and the rest of the scum. They don't contribute anything to the country. They just, oh, Jesus, never mind.
Well, you know, have Jesus cut the cancer out. At least he doesn't charge a copay.
Right, he sure doesn't. All right, Hack, drive safely, all right?
Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it.
All right, man, take care. Take care. He doesn't charge a copay. No, he just wants your whole damn soul. At least that's what these vampires like Robertson talk about. It's just astonishing. It's just astonishing. Hank is in Berkeley, California. Hey, Hank.
Yes.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Last time I saw you out here was in San Francisco.
What now?
Last time I saw you out here in San Francisco.
Oh, were you at the gig there?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I was
okay.
The guy they had to bring up in a wheelchair up the stairs. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay, I remember.
I have a question for you.
Sure.
You got me to listen to Mark Thompson when he first started. And today he had a caller on. Had a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
He had Rush Limbaugh's home address. And he wanted to give it out for everybody to send a letter to the post office.
Uh-huh.
And Mark wouldn't allow him to do that. Now, is that corporate America influencing serious left now?
No, but there are some broadcast standards and practices, Hank, that we follow. I don't know how much longer.
Rush Limbaugh followed him.
Well, he doesn't use the F word. That's one of them. To give out somebody's address, here's my take. If somebody really wants to find someone, you can do that these days with Google Earth, with all the search engines that are available. Even a filthy animal like Limbaugh, and no offense to animals, but even somebody like Limbaugh, I don't think it's a proper thing to do. I would refuse to get down into the slimy pit that he's in. I know that, and give out his address. I know that he would do it in a heartbeat, but you know,
can you imagine him getting 10,000 letters at his home?
I can imagine him getting a million.
Yeah.
But it's just one of the things, even though you'd like to do it, you just don't do it. You know, I talk a lot about when the lights go out, Limbaugh and Beck and Hannity are mine. And that's one thing. Because I mean that literally, when the lights go out. But, you know, to harass them with mail, with letters, wouldn't accomplish anything.
By the way, do you know if Cuba has done anything in terms of Haiti?
I don't know. I'm sure that the Cuban government, the Castro government, is on this.
Chavez, I know, did something.
Say again?
Chavez did do something.
Yeah, Venezuela is. But I'm sure the Castro government is, too. This is not going to be reported with any prominence in American media, though, because,
right.
You know, Castro and Chavez, oh, no, bad guys, right?
And I had one other question.
Sure.
Do you remember the Mexican earthquake a couple of years ago to 7.4?
I do, yes.
What did we do to help them?
I don't remember.
Nothing that I remember.
Nothing. Well, I'm not surprised.
Why do you think that would be?
Say it again?
Why do you think that happened?
What, the Mexican?
That we wouldn't give Mexico to help that.
Oh, why do I think that happened?
Yeah.
I guess because whoever makes these decisions in the Bush government, first of all, they probably figured Mexico could fend for itself, and you don't want to start showing any compassion or charity, in the good sense of that word, to a country like Mexico. The next thing you know, their workers will be coming over here looking for a job, right?
Yeah.
All right, Hank, thanks, man.
Okay, well, thanks for the interview. answering that question. I was just taken aback by that.
Yeah, well,
because, you know, he does so many dirty things every day.
Yeah.
And he needs a little bit of his own medicine.
I think so.
So I wish you guys had let that person give that name or the address.
Well, I couldn't do it.
Yeah, well, but it seemed that Mark was talking about that it was like a fellow people in the fellow industry.
Mm-hmm.
That we got to protect each other.
No, I don't think that was it. I think, like I say, there are, you know, anybody could do it. Yeah, this the talk show host you're talking about could do it. I could do it. But what would be the point of getting into the slime along with Limbaugh? That's something Limbaugh would do. That's something Beck would do. And, you know, I will say and believe and expound on certain things in this program, but I'm not going to get into the slime, the human waste that these guys operate out of. Hank, I got to leave there. Thanks, man. Appreciate you checking in. Bill is in Phoenix. Listening
hey,
online. Hey, Bill.
Did Kathy tell you you might need a tinfoil hat for this one?
Oh, no, not yet. Oh, she's pointing to her head, making a pyramid. All right, go ahead.
All right. Mike, I'm not too sure that this is a natural disaster.
Yeah?
I'm aware that they find oil with, I think it's like 80 watts of power directed to the ground. And they find massive pools
yeah.
of oil, right?
Yeah.
In Alaska, we have mega billions of watts of directable energy called the HAARP Project. Are you aware of the HAARP Project, Mike?
Yeah, I know what the HAARP Project is. Yeah, that's the weather.
It's not just weather, though, Mike.
Oh, it's other than that?
It's directable energy. It's like
okay.
It's like aiming a microwave where you want it.
Uh-huh.
This earthquake occurred very shallowly, 200 feet. All I'm saying, Mike, is that we live in a nation now where, well, if they're hiding anything, right, doesn't reason mm-hmm. dictate that they're hiding everything.
Right.
There are things larger than we can think of or conceive that they're capable of. Surely they're hiding great science from us, Mike. And if they can mimic a natural disaster, wouldn't they?
Well, I mean, there's a good chance that what you're saying is true. I don't know. I don't know, Bill. I don't know much of anything, frankly. Bill, I gotta go. Thanks, man. Appreciate you checking in. We'll be right back. Before the hour, quick mention of our production crew. Military Affairs is Sharon Gordy. Economic Affairs is Bruce Enberg. Education is Kate Petrini. But now I've come back again. Our two ethics advisors, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, and the program is engineered and produced by Kathy Bay. We got time for a couple more phone calls here if you're quick. 877-996-2556. Ron is in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Ron.
Hi, Mike. I've talked to you before, but I just want to point out to your audience on the San Antonio State Hospital website, which, by the way, is a psychiatric facility.
Mm-hmm.
they have on their that next Tuesday is Confederate Heroes Day, and I thought your audience would want to know that they're still celebrated. I mean, those are people that fought for slavery, and I don't think that's a cause for celebration. So I wanted to point that out to y'all.
Oh, God, yeah. Okay, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Sure. Good night. Okay, take care. That's it. Huh. Well. Confederate Heroes Day? Oh, well. I don't know. I'm just kind of shocked. Not about that, about everything else. Richard is in Los Angeles. Richard, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
All right. How are you?
I was listening to the program earlier today with Mark Thompson. You had an earlier caller who was concerned about possibly Mark being in cahoots with Rush Limbaugh or something.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I think Mark's concerns were more legalities of giving out Rush's address over the air,
mm-hmm.
and any legal matters that may open up his show too.
Right.
That's what I thought he was trying to convey to the gentleman who wanted to give out the address.
Mm-hmm.
Now the gentleman did state that he got the address off the internet based upon when Rush was stopped at the airport coming back in from the Dominican Republic,
mm-hmm.
and they found the OxyContin and the other stuff on him. So it was a matter of public record.
I think it was
that he was able to get that.
I think it was Viagra that they found on him. But yeah, like I said, anybody wants to get someone's address, it can be gotten. You may have to pay for it, but it can be gotten. And I'm just not comfortable with that for the same reasons that you mentioned.
Oh no, that's it. Also, I had a take on. Part of what makes Rush such a big thing in certain parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
I drive a truck for a living, and I spend a lot of time in, like, small-town America.
Right.
And you would be surprised how big of an icon he is in a lot of these one-horse towns that I go through.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it is based upon racism.
Right.
A lot of these small towns are, you know, small places where they're 99% predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
The only minorities that are in these towns work jobs like in the kitchen, you know, washing dishes, you know, that type of thing, cleaning up. They're not allowed to associate with the clients at, like, the restaurants and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the mindset is like, you know, a good minority is one that's quiet and does what he's told, and that's all there is to it.
Right.
And these people worship Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the rest of these nutcases.
And the part to me that's always been ironic is the fact that the people who, for the most part, worship, as you say, and I don't disagree with that word, scum like Limbaugh and Hannity and Beck, are people who are just barely getting by. I would imagine that their average yearly incomes or annual incomes fall outside what are usually considered to be the boundaries of the middle class. And here, these right-wing talkers are multimillionaires who couldn't care less about the people who have raised them to this status. They couldn't care less. It's like they don't exist. But that's where their money comes from. I don't understand why people haven't gotten that. Oh, well. Richard, thanks, man. I appreciate you checking in. Mike is in Port Angeles, Washington. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Mike. Good to talk to you again. And I've had something that's been in the back burner for some time, and that is that I live in a small community, I guess, in Port Angeles,
right,
and, right across from Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Rush Limbaugh on in the morning here for 3 hours and have had him on here since I moved here in, 1989?
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite some time that he's been on the radio. I've talked to the station owner or one of the people involved up there several times, and they said, well, that's what the people want. and blah, blah, blah. Well, the majority of our community by far is progressive,
mm-hmm.
by far. And they're running this guy every day. So I was thinking about going to my local Democratic Party, the leadership,
mm-hmm.
and encouraging, seeing if there is a way we couldn't advertise that anybody that's a progressive to pull their advertising off of the local radio, meaning, you know, Bill's window washing service or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Pull your ads off that station if they're going to continue to play it. I happen to know that the station owner is a right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage people to pull all their advertising from these small towns that are playing this crap.
Yeah,
I do not believe that the majority of people are Rush Limbaugh listeners. I think that's bullshit.
No, wait, you can't say that word, Mike. That's a big bad word. Oh my goodness, but that's all right. I understand what you're saying. All right, take care, True Seekers. I'll see you tomorrow night. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.